The next case is 04-1078, Board of Education, the Cleveland Municipal School District versus Cuyahoga County Board of Revision and Vlaxos. Appellant is represented by Mr. Sleggs. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Todd Sleggs, and I'm here representing the appellant Vlaxos LLC. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Thank you. Your Honor, this is a tax year 2000 appeal coming out of Cuyahoga County involving a property that's located in what's known as the Warehouse District on West 6th Street in downtown Cleveland. The Cuyahoga County auditor for the tax year 2000 assessed the property a fair market value of $415,000. And this case comes to the court from a Board of Education increase complaint that was filed in connection with a December 22, 2000 transfer of the property for $1,350,000. The record will reflect that in response to that complaint, the taxpayer filed a countercomplaint and indicated in response to question 9 on the counter complaint that the sale involved business fixtures and was not arm's length. The testimony that was adduced at the hearing before the Cuyahoga County Board of Revision indicated that the tenant who was the buyer in this case was facing a significant increase in rent that was being threatened by the landlord. A copy of the existing lease is in the record in this case, but essentially the rent was going to increase from approximately $16 a square foot to over $40 a square foot, which was a
257% increase. Let me ask you a question on that, Mr. Sleggs. The
yes.
Lease agreement, which is in the record, talks about a 5-year extension at a fixed predetermined price. And my question is, why wasn't the lease extended?
Your Honor, there is a provision on page 126 in the supplement the tenant would be considered a holdover tenant at the expiration of the first period of the lease, and it's my understanding that that's what prompted the negotiations of a new rental amount.
He did not have the right to extend for?
They had to agree to what the new rent would be under the lease. There is a provision.
It says here something about option to renew no later than 6 months prior to the expiration of the current lease term, which was 5 years or 10 years.
The lease under its initial term ended on April 14th of 1998.
April 14th.
And I'm looking at the supplement on page 114.
April 14th, 1998.
And based upon the testimony of Mr. Servetus in the record, at the time of the sale, he was paying under, and this is on page 114, a little over the $6,281.33 per month figure, which would be a continuation of the existing rent, which, as I read the lease, would be a continuation as a holdover tenant. Under page 126 in the supplement, there's a provision that deals with the rent that would remain in effect at the expiration of the initial term.
Well, it says here, no later than 6 months prior to the expiration of the current lease, tenant may in writing request landlord to, and landlord shall, if requested, notify tenant of the rental on the same terms and conditions as this lease and upon which landlord is willing to lease. Then there, for a period of 5 additional years. Okay, if we ended in 98, there seems to be a time period gap there.
That's correct. There isn't any evidence in the record that the tenant exercised that notice provision.
Right.
And my reading of Mr. Servetus's testimony is that at the expiration of the initial term, that's when the negotiations with the landlord began.
So
over the proposed
we had quite a time period there that they were negotiating.
That's correct. It would have been over a year, almost a year and a half, actually a little more, a little over a year and a half.
Okay.
But his testimony in the record does indicate that at the time of the sale, he was continuing to pay the 6,200 and some dollar rental amount.
In the settlement agreement on page 4 of the record,
yes,
there's an amount paid of $17,500 to the Essex Real Estate Group. Is that a broker? Who is that?
I believe Mr. Servetus does make reference to that payment. He testified that in the record that they had contacted appraisers, but none of the appraisers could come close to the sale price. That shows that to be some type of a loan charge, and I don't know other than the fact that line 802 identifies that as a loan discount fee, that would be a fee to an appraiser.
Okay, on page 19 of the supplement, which is page 5 of the purchase agreement.
Yes, sir.
Says purchaser and seller, number 14.
That's correct.
Warrant each other this agreement was procured through the services of Landmark Management Limited. Now, who's that?
That's actually an entity that is controlled by the seller of the property.
Is it a broker?
I believe that it is the Landmark Management Limited was the management company for the Grand Arcade property. So it would have been an entity that was related to the seller.
Okay. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm just looking to see if Landmark's also noted in the lease, but they may also be noted in the lease documentation.
Okay.
When we appeared before the Board of Revision, the record will show that we did provide the board with a copy of the Lakeside decision. We also discussed the Walters case, and it's our position that the sale in this particular case does not meet the definition of arm's length as defined by this court in the Walters case because of the fact that the buyer was compelled to purchase the property. We also feel that the facts in our case mirror the Lakeside decision. But before I get into those two cases, I'd like to touch on 4 points in the Board of Tax Appeals decision, which I do not believe are supported by the record in this case. Our argument before this court is essentially twofold. We feel that the Board of Tax Appeals' factual findings in this case are unreasonable based upon the record. We do not believe that reasonable minds could look at the testimony and evidence in this case and find this to be a valid sale, and that secondly, we believe that the Board of Tax Appeals has misapplied the Lakeside decision of this court to the facts in this case. The Board of Tax Appeals at page 11 in their decision talks about the fact that since Blaxos was able to finance the property, that is an indication that this is a valid sale. But if the court looks at the record in this case, it's clear that the buyer had to go to fairly extraordinary measures in order to purchase this property. 2 loans were taken out, not just a conventional real estate loan from Metropolitan Bank, but they also had to go to the Small Business Administration to get a loan.
Yeah, that raises a question in my mind. I think there was an allegation in the brief or someplace that Vlaxos had to pledge personal property or something. And I didn't see that. They signed a personal guarantee.
That's correct.
But I didn't see any pledge of personal property.
Well, there is a UCC filing that's in the supplement at page, I believe it's page, let me just check the supplement here. I have it marked in my notes at page 18 in the supplement, but I think that's too short.
There's a page 109 of UCC filing, but that's for Blaxos LLC.
That's correct.
But that's not them personally.
Yes, but that is the assets of the company, which was essentially the restaurant.
Seems to me that's sort of a normal course. If I'm going to finance this thing, I want take a financing statement on the personal property.
Right.
Just like I take a mortgage on the real property.
That's correct, and that's why we made the allocation that trades fixtures were involved in the transfer, because if you look at the record in this case, we were essentially buying back our own trade fixtures, because under the lease, the trade fixtures, which Mr. Servetus testified, totaled about $725,000.
Yeah.
There's about $600,000 reported in the county returns in the record, would have remained at the property. So we had essentially purchased our own trade fixtures as part of this transaction. We think the UCC filing is further evidence of that, that it wasn't just a real estate transfer. But the personal guarantee...
I don't see that as evidence, but go ahead.
Okay. The personal guarantees of Mr. Servetus and Mr. Stavris are in the record as well,
right.
And we feel that that further demonstrates the fact that this wasn't a typical real estate deal where the lender was looking only to the real estate. Mr. Servetus also testified that they were required to keep certain accounts at the bank. He testified that the bank wanted to have control over everything. And then, as the court noted early on, there is no evidence that there were any appraisals done in this case, and Mr. Servetus' testimony is that they couldn't get anybody to appraise the property close to the sale price. The next finding of the Board of Tax Appeals is that there, on page 11 in their decision in order, that there was no evidence that Vlaxos would have ceased to do business. And I think this totally ignores Mr. Servetus' testimony. His testimony was, I can lose everything or I can take the risk and say, okay, we're going to pay it. He talked to his lawyer, he talked to his business partner, he talked to his wife, and all of them said, you have no choice. And so from Mr. Servetus' perception, he really had no choice in this case. He was going to go out of business.
Is that evidence in the record?
Yes, it is. It's in his testimony before the Board of Revision.
Okay.
And I am concerned that the Board of Tax Appeals did not listen to the Board of Revision tape in this case, because I think a lot of their findings are contrary to Mr. Servetus' testimony, which is why I attempted to supplement the record with a transcript of the Board of Tax of the Board of Revision tape. But the court, I hope, has a tape recorder and they will listen to his testimony, because I think it's essential to a lot of the errors that were alleged.
I've listened to it.
Yeah.
Some parts of it are inaudible, unfortunately.
That's correct.
And then there are some parts I get not quite a strong opinion is what you're stating.
Yeah, Mr. Servetus has a very heavy accent, and so it's often difficult to understand what he's saying. But I think on the central points in this case, his testimony is very emphatic and very clear. He testified that when you close a restaurant, 75% of the equipment and food system, stuff like that, stay at the property. And so when the Board of Tax Appeals says there's no evidence that Vlaxos would cease to do business, effectively, if they leave this location, they're leaving their business there. They can't take all this stuff out and go someplace else and open up the same restaurant. He said it's not like an office building, and I think the Board of Tax Appeals really missed that point. And I think that's really part of the duress issue in this case. I mean, it's one thing for the landlord to get into a negotiation with a tenant about a rent increase, but in this particular case, the buyer had a vested interest in this location. He and his wife had spent 7 years building up this restaurant. They had invested a lot of money in trade fixtures, and for them to walk away would have been a significant loss. And I think that Mr. Servetus' testimony clearly shows that in this particular case. The last thing that the Board of Tax Appeals touched on, or really second to the last thing, is that there was no evidence that alternative properties were available. And again, this goes back to Mr. Servetus' analogy that this isn't an office, this is a restaurant. The location means something. We'd invested a lot of money
in. There was no testimony from him that he had looked and value, you know, for other locations and priced them and said, you know, I could get something over here or I could get something there.
The testimony in the record, Your Honor, is that he had talked about what the rental rates were for adjacent locations. And if you look at one of the exhibits in the supplement on page 133, he talks about the two spaces next to his location and what they're renting for. His is obviously the hashed property. Capital Clothing is one over from his, and what's identified as bookstore is the property that he describes as the market restaurant that's immediately adjacent. But the rents for those particular properties were significantly less than what he was even paying under his existing lease. The last thing is the Board of Tax Appeals on page 12 finds that while subjective motivations were present in the case, they didn't raise to the level of duress. And I don't know how you can listen to Mr. Servetus' testimony and make that finding. He constantly said, I have no choice. His advisors told him he had no choice. His wife told him he had no choice. His partner told him he had no choice. This was clearly a man who didn't feel that he had any power to negotiate against the landlord. And for that reason, we feel that the sale should have been disregarded by the Board of Tax Appeals. It was properly disregarded by the county board in this case.
And we send it back. What happens?
The auditor's value should be reinstated because the burden in the appeal before the Board of Tax Appeals was on the school board. They did not come forward with any additional evidence. The Board of Tax Appeals merely decided the case based upon the record, and we feel that in that particular situation, they should have affirmed the Board of Revision decision.
Should they introduce the conveyance statement, and that would be the value? You don't think you bear any burden to show a different value?
I think we rebutted the validity of the sale, and that when we rebut their evidence, then there's nothing for the Board of Tax Appeals to do but to affirm the auditor's value.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hewitt.
Mr. Master Commissioner, may it please the court. I am James Hewitt III, counsel for the Appalachian Cleveland Municipal School District. I'm sure you're familiar that the parties waived their right to hearing before the BTA and relied on the statutory transcript. You are certainly familiar that the Board of Education filed this original complaint with the County Board of Revision, requesting that the property be valued at $1,350,000 in accordance with the recent sales price. The Board of Revision unfortunately did not accept that and maintain the auditor's value. The undisputed record before the BTA established all of the following, that prior to the sale, that the property was owned by the seller known as West Six Associates, and that the appellant leased the property and used it as a restaurant. The appellant, Vlaxos, purchased the property for $1,350,000 on December 22, 2000. The purchase agreement executed by the properties identified the property as being purchased for $1,350,000, upon which the Board of Education filed its complaint. Notably, when you review the settlement statement, Your Honor, there's no mention of personal property in the settlement statement at all, and the conveyance fee indeed is on the entire purchase price amount of $1,350,000. There's discussion within the record, again, that the price was the seller originally wanted $1,600,000 or $1,800,000, and it was actually negotiated down to $1,350,000. The appellant found two loans from Metropolitan Bank, which were executed for a total amount of $1,300,000. The bank asked for typical kinds of things, that is a mortgage and a security interest in the business assets. Personal assets of the principals were not requested. As noted, again, the parties waived their right to hearing. So the Board of Tax Appeals has nothing but the statutory transcripts here. So it's also important to show what it was not shown. The appellant did not call any expert witnesses, and as you said in the earlier case, Your Honor, where is the evidence that the property owner overpaid? That should have been done through appraisal evidence. Other than statements of Mr. Servetus, nothing was even tended to establish sales price other than was in accord with the relevant real estate market, and the BTA reviewed all the undisputed evidence. It showed that the price had been negotiated. It noted that normal market forces were at work and the parties negotiated this down. There was no evidence whatsoever that the appellant would go out of business if it did not purchase the property. Despite all this, the BTA accepted the sales price as the best evidence and ordered the county auditor to assess the subject at $1,350,000. Again, the Board of Education would observe that the court should take notice that the appellant attempted to submit a transcript of the proceedings before the BOR, which were not transcribed by a court reporter. We had concern about that. We asked for a motion to strike, which was granted by the court. And you'll also observe the reply brief essentially tries to get the transcript in when he knew it couldn't come in otherwise. So what does the record, does the BTA have? It has to decide whether there is evidence, and there is none. It doesn't meet the standards with respect to Lakeside Avenue LTD partnership to show economic coercion. I mean, it also shows that this particular property owner had to do none of the contortions required by Lakeside. I mean, they were able to get financing. There were no government forces at place. There was no refusal to negotiate a sales price. I mean, in Lakeside, of course, there was a refusal to negotiate the sales price. There was a combination of financing from a variety of sources. There was appraisal evidence showing that the price that was asking for was outrageous. None of that is present here. None of the personal assets of the two principals were required, and nothing more than typical security interests that are requested in any commercial transaction. I mean, just to address some of the questions you had, Mr. Master Commissioner, the Essex Real Estate appears to me a mortgage originator. But they found a quality Class A borrower that was willing to finance this transaction. Landmark is a management company for the seller. I'm familiar with this particular seller, and again, no brokerage commission is involved. Again, no personal property is noted, again, on the settlement statement. Vlaxo's principals, again, did not pledge any personal property. Typical UCCs on trade fixtures were all that were required. Regarding the testimony of Mr. Servatus, it's not in the record. And more importantly, this business about rents for alternative properties, those are bookstores and clothing stores, and certainly are not a very popular, successful restaurant in Cleveland's Warehouse District, which is adjacent to Cleveland's Jacobs Field and Arena District, and essentially is hot property in downtown Cleveland. This particular property owner, we would submit that there was no evidence of forced sales between related parties. He certainly fails regarding coercion. We believe that the Board of Tax Appeals correctly evaluated all of this evidence. We believe that it's reasonable and lawful, and we would ask that the decision be affirmed by this court.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hewitt. Mr. Slaggs, you're a little bit over. I'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, the conveyance fee statement on page 3 in the supplement does show that there was $100,000 in personal property that transferred. So clearly there was personal property that transferred in this case. And also, as I mentioned in my argument earlier, we were buying back our business fixtures. And business fixtures are trade fixtures, and they're clearly not real estate under 5702 of the Ohio Revised Code. There were no appraisals done based on Mr. Servatus' testimony that would support the purchase price in this particular case. With respect to the transcription of the tape, I would just indicate to the court that I contacted the Board of Tax Appeals. There is no provision by which a party can have a tape transcribed before the Board of Tax Appeals. I merely did it to assist the court in this case, and I feel that the court should have left it in the transcript, but I abide by the court's ruling in this case. The last point that I'd like to make is that Mr. Servatus did testify that the one is a restaurant next door is a market. So there was testimony of what rents for restaurants.
Is there a big difference in size? Do we know anything about the size of the areas next door? And
if you go to the page in the supplement that I directed to that shows you the diagram.
Yeah.
It's page
133.
Forgive me, 133. Our space in the record is a little over, is 5,000 square feet, and then or basically 4,711 square feet, and then they had to take the, what's shown as the dry cleaner space for their dumpsters, which was another 300 square feet. The property identified as the bookstore next door is 2,940 square feet.
So.
And then if you add up the Capital Clothing Store portion, their facility is closer in size to ours because you have to add up 1,942, 1,627, and 1,164.
You have the corner property, though.
We have the corners, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Slaggs.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted to the court, and you will be advised of the result. Thank you.